As the number one selling walk-in tub in North America, SafeStep walk-in tubs are built to maximize your safety and comfort. Each tub comes standard with a dual hydrotherapy system, so you can enjoy the luxuries of bathing comfortably at home. Soothing jets increase mobility and ease pain, while the rainfall shower head refreshes you from head to toe. Visit SafeStepTub.com today to request your free quote and ask about our special offers.
Is everything in here yours, or is it?
Guilty.
Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to an episode that I have been wanting to put out for months, absolutely months. And the timing of putting this episode out was all about making sure that it represented the timing of the one of the best shows of the year, specifically for Porsche, but even just car content, it's absolutely fantastic. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Megaphonics, and I'm talking about the Boxing Gas and Frank Cassidy Heritage episode. Before I get into that, I wanted to address... Yeah, again, saying that I'd be putting something out weekly, and then there'd be a bit of a gap. And I reference, it's funny actually, editing this episode over the last couple of days to make sure it goes out this weekend for bank holiday. And in this episode, I reference losing a dog. My wife and I had three. We are now down to one. So we've lost another one. My dog, Bodhi, he was 13. Kind of beautiful collie lurcher mix, softest temperament you'd ever see, just the nicest dog. So it's been a bit of a tough one for me, definitely, because I've just not felt motivated, if I'm completely honest. And I talk about it in this episode with Frank as well, about, you know, just the feeling of wanting to apologize, not putting content out, and then actually reflecting on, we've all got individual lives and we've all got things that are going on, and this is one of them I just needed to focus on, me and my wife, and making sure that we're okay. So that's why things have been a bit slow. I've only got one dog left. She seems to be okay at the moment, so I think it's fairly unlikely that we're going to lose her as well. But two dogs in 6 months is tough going, so as I'm sure you can imagine. But so I guess the other thing that pops up is that when I start dropping the playlist about, and that's coming pretty much straight after this, my Cayman, my 981 base Cayman, and the kind of selling of it originally, the buying the 991.2 Carrera T, and then selling that, and then modifying my old Cayman. That whole kind of string of episodes is going to come out quite quickly, after another. They're pretty much edited and ready to go. And he pops up, Bodhi pops up in those constantly. So this isn't going to be a tribute to him. This is all about Frank and Frank's legacy that he's leaving, and the incredible, well, he calls it a business park, I think it's more than that, but this is all dedicated to Frank, but those episodes that are coming out will be dedicated to Bodhi and his memory. So getting back onto this episode, so Megaphonics was 2 weeks ago now, for 2023. It lived up to expectations. It was bigger again. I can see where Frank's vision is going now. He's kind of developed and built the buildings around the back of the site. When this episode took place, I think it was March this year, February, March this year, those weren't complete. So, and the intro, actually, the important thing for this is, not only is this an audio drop, but very proud to say that actually, God, the YouTube channel, which is, that's where all this started, was for a YouTube channel, not for a podcast. The podcast was supposed to supplement it, and it's been the other way around. Looks like the editing's finished. Where was I going with that? Cut this bit. Yeah, so the YouTube was supposed to be the main focus, and the supplement was supposed to be the podcast, but it didn't end up working that way. But I've spent a decent amount of time editing it, and I'm so proud of how it's come out. As much the conversation with Frank and I is fantastic, but also actually I think I've done a pretty decent job of the edit and kind of putting something together that's engaging to watch. It's long form. Make no apologies for that. Some of them will be shorter. Some of them will be 15, 20 minute episodes, but this has got a good intro, and then Frank and I get to it and have a good old chin wag. And it really does feel like two mates sat in a pub, having a good old chin wag. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, then stay tuned, and don't forget to head over to YouTube if you want to watch the visuals of that as well, because both the audio will be on this and the audio will be on YouTube, because people seem to stream audio from YouTube these days as well, but also the actual visuals as well will go out as a proper episode. This, for me, marks the start of the split between the earlier stuff that I put out for Rengineering, like the one with Sam from Seeing Through Glass, and it was really exposing how little I knew, and then this I think is the episode where it kind of changes into, this guy's learned some stuff. So and I've learned some stuff, so I really hope you enjoy that. I'd love some feedback, actually. So if you watch it, or even if you listen to the audio on YouTube, definitely drop some comments. If you want to leave a review, that would be fantastic. On any of the podcast streaming services, they typically have an option to review. Five stars would be grateful, but whatever. Someone commented on a YouTube, one of the earlier episodes, I think, of the podcast on YouTube, and it was about some of the audio not being particularly clear for the people I was interviewing. There's a really great spot, actually, and I do my best to clean it up and to make it as good as I can, but obviously if I'm using one of these Lavalier lapel mics and then kind of holding it out basically for the other person to talk into, it doesn't always capture. It's really hard to get that to be consistent. So in response, this is kind of what you do in engineering, right? If you had a failure or kind of something that wasn't working as you expect it to, you investigate, you find the root cause, and then you come up with a solution. I've done exactly the same with this. So investigate it. The Lavalier mic doesn't work really as a boom mic or a kind of shared mic. The response to that was, sang in a band for a little while, so I've got an Shure SM58 dynamic mic, and I've got a little plug-in thing that goes into the bottom of it as well, that's a recorder, and then a Dead Cat windsock for the top. So the feedback is supposed to be brilliant for that, so you should see that the audio recording for your Porsche stories when they're on the hop and I'm out at an event or something, and I pick one of those, that should be pretty good from here on in. And actually, at Cars and Coffee, the Rengineering Cars and Coffee, which happens on the 3rd of September at Winchester Coffee Roasters, that's the first one of those, I'm really happy to say. That sold out, by the way. I'm going to try and do some of those there. I referenced this a long time ago, 356 and a chap called Alex Nash, and we've been talking for months about doing a proper episode. When we're at Boxing Gas at Megaphonics, Ryan, the guy that does all the editing for me, all the shots for, not the editing, but the sort of filmography, he shot a load of the B-roll for this. So there is a really good 356 Your Porsche story coming up, and I will be recording the audio to that and some of the visuals, but mostly the audio, at Cars and Coffee. So I would say head over to Instagram at Rengineering UK, and the next Cars and Coffee event, tickets go out on Eventbrite, but absolutely free. I just want to see you guys and learn as much as I can about your Porsches. So that'd be great if you head over there and you can pick your tickets up as I drop a story, and the link will be in the bio. Anyway, I've done enough chat now. It's been 8 minutes of my rubbish. So I'm going to hand over to myself and Frank in the mezzanine area of his Black Betty and Company. I'm so proud of this. Anyway, I really hope you enjoy it. Love to hear some of your feedback, and I'll catch you up at the end. Anyway, right, so if it's all right with you, we've done a bit about me, can we start from very young Frank?
Okay.
Yeah. So for me, getting into cars was birth, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So apparently, again, I hear from my old man that I wouldn't sleep unless he chucked me in the back of his MG BGT and then took me for a drive and I fell asleep.
In back of what car?
An MG BGT.
Okay, yeah.
Or Triumph Spitfire, one of the two. But like 70s crappy kind of sports cars. But yeah, so what's what? Where did it start for you? Is it that early, or was it a bit later? Or
yeah, so Mum says, and I'm not going to correct her because it sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Well, Mum tells me that apparently my first word was vroom.
Really?
Apparently so.
Right.
Apparently so. I just watched cars go down, you know, the road through a window or whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So apparently that was my first word. And then whenever she used to take me to the park, she'd have to strap me into a pushchair, even though the park was about 5 minutes walk away. Because otherwise I'd stop at every single car on the way down to right. to the park. So I don't know what that is. It gets to a point where you start thinking, okay, well, how much of it is nurturing and how much of it is nature?
Yeah.
I don't know. So maybe there's something intrinsically in me that was like, ooh, I like the shape of that and I like the sound of that.
Because it's multi-sensory, isn't it? And as a kid, I'm just thinking off the fly, but smells, sights, sounds, it's all there pretty much.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's that, as a kid.
I don't know, interestingly enough, like my dad worked for a big car brand. I don't know the full details. That sounds really weird. Basically, what it is that my birth father, I was adopted at birth. I found maybe, what was it, 2-3 years ago now? And it transpired that he was a car guy. He's a massive car guy. He's massively into German cars.
Right.
And actually, he was working for an American car brand on the border of Mexico and Texas. So I don't know. I guess it's in my nature, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So where did Porsche come in then? Was it?
Porsche came in from my adoptive father.
Okay.
So the my dad had, well, no. So my mum bought me The Love Bug, a 1967 film, about a Volkswagen Beetle. And I fell in love with that. I don't know, the sound, the shape of it, whatever it was. So I got really into that. And then my dad bought a 1983, I guess it must have been, a Targa.
Okay.
Guards red, black leather interior.
Just out of curiosity,
that cemented it for me.
A, has he still got that car?
Yeah.
And have you got an 83 Targa?
No, I don't. So he hasn't got that car. He sold it to a friend who took it to France and who had it in France for many years. And then when his friend wanted to buy it back, we bought it back, or my dad bought it back.
Wow, that's cool.
And then he had it for, I don't know, 10 years or something of the sort. And then in his infinite wisdom, he decided to sell it. And he sold it for $5,000. I mean, that's what they were worth at the time. He sold it for fuck all. And this is like the genesis of my obsession with Porsche.
Yeah,
I love my dad, but there's a part of me that does dislike him for having sold that piece of my heart, I guess. And then it was sold to someone else. He still has it till this day, because I managed to track it down. I think it was about 5-6 years ago.
Right.
But he's got no interest in selling it.
Really?
But it's exactly as I remember it.
Wow.
And it's still, I think he's had it repainted since. He's rebuilt the gearbox. Apparently that blew up shortly after he bought it off my dad.
Is it repainted guards red still? Or is it
still guards red.
Oh, well, at least
still on
something.
The cookie, cookie cutters, still on the Teledar wheels. And when I got in touch with him, he said to me, "Do you know why the dashboard is all scratched? The top part of the what do you call it? The dashboard over, you know, the bit that goes over the gauges."
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. It's because my mum used to drive around with big rings, because she used to drive us around in that car actually when we were kids. She had baby seats in the back. She used to take us to school in that car, and so she had big rings. And so when she was driving the car, she would." I don't know how she did it. It must have been huge, because there is still quite a bit of quite a distance between the steering wheel and the thing. Yeah. But she would brush, I guess, the top of the binnacle,
Right.
and as a result, destroyed the dash. Now, I wear jewellery, I wear big rings, and I've never had that problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know exactly how she did it, but she did. So it's still got those scuffs, apparently, on the dash.
Do you know what, though? That's the stuff I would never change.
Well, yeah, absolutely, of course. Like, if I ever got that car back.
You want to preserve
that. And if he changed
that.
It, if he retrimmed the dashboard, it would break my heart. Yeah. But then again, it's his car, his rules now. Yeah. It's nothing to do with me anymore.
Going back to watches, though, I mean, that's the same for me. Like, so I've got another watch that GMT Pepsi, and I'll probably keep that quite nice. This, again, my wedding watch, we were talking about this off camera a minute ago. Every mark, every scratch, there's a dent in it from where we went on honeymoon, and I smashed it on the train side of the train door. Mm. But those things don't annoy me at all, because that is a part of, you know, and I'm sure it's you with that dash, right? If you got that car back, you know, we all move on to other realms or whatever at some point, and you're an old guy and you look and you're history, your heritage baked into those scratches.
Totally, it tells a story. I mean, there's, I don't know, a brand new 911 that's just rolled off the forecourt, and it's box fresh is a little bit boring to me.
Yeah.
You know, whereas a 911 that's got loads of patina and scratches and dents and mismatched color and this and the other is a much more interesting car. It tells a story. It's been on adventures, you know, and I think that's part of the fun of classic older cars. And there's a friend of mine, called Sy Medlicott. He's a brilliant photographer as well, and Porsche guy, and he's got a 240 72 car, stunning thing, and it is covered in road rash, the paint's cracking in all sorts of places, and it just looks absolutely awesome. It just tells the story.
It's mad, isn't it? It's better for it, and yet people chase after the perfect car. And I to an extent I get, I mean, this is what I did with my Cayman, right? So I bought the lowest mileage, cleanest version I could, 14,000 miles, dry weather car only, with the intention of keeping it forever. And then a couple of people, there's a few marks here and there, but I'm again, totally happy with the, I don't want to damage it, like purposefully damage the thing, but if it picks up the odd stone chip here and there, like, bring it on.
That's part of life. That stone chip is an Alpine pass. This piece of rubber that's melted onto the bodywork is from that track day. You know, it's fun. There's my Olive ST I took on 3,000 miles across Europe of up and down Alpine passes, and it's got stone rash all down the sides now, you know. And it just adds to the character. It is what it is. It's a car. You know, as long as it's mechanically sound and it gets me from A to B with a huge grin on my fucking face, then that's all that fucking matters.
That's the win. Yeah.
I don't really care about that. There's a big dent in the bonnet of that car.
Really?
You know, because I was called, I think one time, like an idiot, I couldn't, for some reason or another, I pressed on too hard on the bonnet and I managed to make a little dent just underneath the badge. But again, it doesn't slow me down. I don't really care. The car still works well. And I guess one day if I ever sell it, then yeah, I'll knock out that dent.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll probably give the paint a bit of a refresh. But in the meantime, it means I don't need to baby it. I don't need to be careful about it.
Yeah.
And I can just enjoy the car.
Yeah.
And focus the money that I'm going to spend on that car on things which are important, like doing a gearbox rebuild or doing the really good service and making sure everything mechanically is tip-top condition.
Yeah.
Because that's the stuff that really matters, yeah.
Definitely. Going back to that Targa then, so we've got to the point where kind of got the bug, you've got, you know, literally you've been watching the bug on TV and you've got this Targa that's kind of giving you the goosebumps as you're going in it. There's a step, there's a journey between that though and becoming an adult and being in a situation where you're in a fortunate enough position to even start collecting cars. But what was the first one? What was the first Porsche that you owned at that point?
First 911 was a 964.
Was seven. It the first one was a 911?
Yeah, it was a 964 and it was a 7 grand car.
Right.
Yeah. So back in those days, the 964 was the car that nobody wanted.
Which is wild, isn't it, when you look at it today?
It is, but to me, it's wild the other way around.
Right.
You know, I look at 964s now and think, how the hell is that a £1.8 million Singer?
Singer
DLS, which is a phenomenal car. I get it. You know, what's called, I'm sure it's worth that. The amount of engineering that's gone into it, 4 valves per cylinder, all the rest of it is absolutely incredible, sure. But to me, a 964 is an 8 grand car.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's in my 20s going, I'm going to buy 7 grand, you know, 964. And my dad saying to me that I'm a complete idiot, that it's going to be
financial suicide.
It's going to be financial suicide and that I should buy a reasonably priced hatchback at the end of it. And he was absolutely fucking right. I mean, the car leaked oil like a sieve. I traveled around with a 5 litre bottle of oil in the rear of it behind the seat. Because everywhere I went, it just leaked so much oil. And you couldn't see out the rear window. So if you were going along the motorway, for example, the oil would come up round the back and it would lie on the top of the rear screen and you just end up with this greasy mess on the rear glass. But it was an absolute mess. But yeah, in those days, that's what they were worth. They were worth nothing.
So people weren't spending any money on them?
No.
Maintaining them at that
point. And so what's interesting about the 964 is that it was born in the 90s and the 90s recession. So there weren't that many that were built and sold. And it was the first year of the four-wheel drive, so all the purists hated the car.
Right.
Because in 89, it was only available in four-wheel drive.
Was it really? Right, yeah. There you go. So Heritage, that's like a nugget for me, because yeah. I would not have known that.
Yeah, so 89 was the... In 89, you could only get it as a Carrera 4. It was only till 1990 that they started doing it as a C2. So you had this car that was born in the 90s at a time when there was a recession. So not many were bought. On top of that, it was plagued by bad press because all the purists and all the journalists were like, what is this newfangled four-wheel drive system that's ruining the purity of this car that we're obsessed with? So all the articles for 89 when it was launched were negative. Plus, also, there was no... it used a dual mass flywheel, which had failures.
Yeah.
So that didn't help either. And it also didn't had sealing rings. So it was leaking oil like a sieve anyway from the get-go. So all of a sudden you had all these little elements coming together to give you a recipe for a car that was underappreciated and that would eventually become cheap as chips. And the people wouldn't spend money on because it wasn't worth anything. And it also had those huge, deformable bumpers as well.
Yeah,
which everybody
yeah.
thought was really, really ugly. And actually, it's funny how designs can sometimes age so well and change. But so that car was, I mean, I bought it because it was the only 911 I could afford.
Yeah.
And there was a whole rabble of us who were buying these 964s and modifying them because it didn't really matter because they were high mileage and they weren't necessarily very well looked after anyway. So you could do it without batting an eyelid. And we were also tracking them, and if you slammed it into a wall, it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
You just call up the scrapyard, Douglas Valley, or Porsche part at the time or whatever, and get a new wing bolted on, away you go. It didn't really matter. It was a cheap car.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a laugh. In the meantime, the brand new 996 was out, and that was the Porsche that everybody wanted.
Right.
For me, though, I've never been interested necessarily in new things. I like old things. Mm. I like things that have a story to tell, have an interesting history, an interesting backstory. And also, I'm a sucker for good design, and I
you
always
can tell
that.
I mean, that is dripping out of this place, right?
Oh, that's kind, but yeah, I'm a sucker for design, and so new designs often enough. I don't think I've had the time to mellow and to really mature. Yeah. And actually, with an older car, it's had time to mature and to mellow. Yeah. So So you can tell what looks good and what doesn't look good. Whereas new designs, often enough, you can't tell quite yet whether that's going to age well.
And it's funny you say that, because, again, if you look at that series of cars up until the 996, you can see there's a gentle iteration. Like, the profile is generally the same. The top, the body's the same. And then I think you're right. So 996 onwards, it's almost like how quickly they're probably working on the 99 whatever it's going to be 903 or whatever 903.
They say they're 4 years.
Four years.
Apparently, the motor industry generally is about 4 years.
Which is crazy because, like you said, it's not fermenting. It's like that fermentation process that just gently bubbles away, and then somebody kind of discovers something and you can smooth something out or kind of make more of something else. But it's still that gentle iteration. Going back to Royal Oaks and Rolex and lots of other brands with watches and stuff, not a lot changes. But it's again, this is off camera, but the detail for me is the important bits. Mm. You move the game on massively and change something so radically, it then becomes, it's hard to connect, right? The lineage for me for that.
Yeah.
So I totally get stopping there, stopping pre-996.
But but I haven't.
Okay.
I've owned water-cooled Porsches.
Right, right.
I always get pigeonholed as an air-cooled guy.
Right.
And I get that, and I deserve it. What's called, my cars are air-cooled, and that's what really sets me on fire. But I have. That doesn't mean that, one, I haven't owned water-cooled cars, and two, that I don't appreciate them.
Sure.
So
sure.
I've owned a 997 Turbo.
Okay.
Phenomenal car. Huge amount of respect. Mind-bending. I mean, the fact that it can be a daily driver and have that much power is absolutely obscene to me.
Right.
And it's something that I can only appreciate. I mean, you can't not appreciate the amount of engineering that goes into making something that's capable of doing that on a daily basis.
Mm.
And that could be driven by your nan. 600 horsepower, whatever it is. I don't know how much they are. What are they, 400, 500 horsepower? Something like that?
450.
It doesn't matter. The point is, it's an obscene amount of horsepower to get down the road.
Yeah.
And your nan could drive it.
Yeah.
And that, the engineering that goes into that is something that I cannot not appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
So I appreciate new cars and the engineering that goes into them hugely, massively so. And I love my 997 Turbo. I mean, it was a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
Most cars are good at doing one thing or another. I mean, the 911, generally speaking, throughout all its generations, but especially the new ones, are capable of doing everything. A roads, B roads, motorways, and everything else in between. You know, four seats, huge amounts of luggage space once you put the rear seats down. I mean, they're just phenomenal cars. So I do appreciate water cool cars. We've had a KN that was a fantastic car as well.
Right, okay.
But an early, what was it? I think it was a Gen 1 or a Gen 2, I forget. No, it must have been Gen 1. It was a Gen 1 GTS. And that was an absolutely brilliant car. So yeah, I do appreciate modern metal too.
I'm going to stick to my thread, I think, and kind of live in that for a sec. It's not that I don't appreciate water cooled stuff. I do. I appreciate what it can do, but everything, and it's probably why I bought a base Cayman and I wasn't particularly bothered about speed for me or anything like that. Everything's about emotion for me. So what creates emotion? And I find it, and it's part of the reason why I sold my Carrera T that I was talking to you about earlier on. It didn't generate the same feelings for me. Mm. And I chase that. I don't chase what the Nürburgring lap time is. I don't chase how quick somebody is at the top end. I'm not bothered at all. I don't care. I need to want to get up in the morning and go and drive it, or just go and sit in the garage with it, and whatever it does. If Porsche creates something new that does that, fine. Hmm. So far, I find it more difficult to access that emotionally than I do older stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not a criticism of those cars. Yeah. It's a completely personal thing to me, which is why weirdly the 981 Cayman is. So when I was going through like what should I buy, because I came out of a really heavily modified Lotus Elise, and I was trying to work out. I wanted a Cayman R. I was kind of looking at that as 911s. Yeah, great, but if I was going to buy a 911, I really wanted an air cooled car, and it was just beyond budget. I wanted something small. I felt like 911, even 997.1 onwards, less so 996, but that kind of era. And I was looking at, I don't want a heavily compromised car that I'm gonna have to spend 15 grand at Hartech on in 6 months. Yeah. I didn't want that. Mm. So that kind of left me with Cayman for size, 987.2 or 981, 718 at that point didn't have the 4-liter GTS. So it's kind of like, I don't want a 4-cylinder car. I want that 6-cylinder thing. I want that. I wanted something special to me. And then I was like, well, what can I get for the apps? What's the best version of this car in the best? And I'll try and be as flexible as I can on most things. I really wanted a basic Porsche iconic color. Mm. So it would have been Guards red or white or, you know, or black or something that was kind of like real bare bones Porsche color. And I ended up stumbling on that kind of 981. I was like, well, that's it. The spec's perfect. It's got hardly any miles. I can kind of, I'll do more miles on it very quickly, and it suddenly become completely my car. Yeah. But then I was trying to, and this is the point I was trying to get to, is that I kind of went off that idea probably about 2 or 3 years in, because it was PCP, so I couldn't do anything to it. It was like not my car. Mm. Bought this Carrera T thinking, well, it's a 911. It's quite low run in terms of how many they've made. You know, I like something that's kind of, there's fewer about, you know, even if people said it was marketing exercise. And realized really quickly that everything I wanted originally, small, relatively lightweight, or that's not, if you park a 981 or a 987 next to a 964 or something, they're not the same, but you can kind of see that the size is sort of similar.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think I agree with you. I think if the day comes that I buy a new Porsche product, and it will, you know, that I do it again, I will of course dip toes again in newer stuff. I think there's a real sweet spot with the Caymans. Yeah. Mm. I think there's a nice size to them. You know, the reality is that what's called, I boil it down to how do I use the car?
Yeah.
And that defines everything for me.
Okay, cool.
So the thing that I enjoy the most is Alpine touring.
Right.
So what does that mean? That means it needs to be able to get me from the UK in relative comfort to a degree to the Alps, and then be raucous when I'm out there and perfect for the job. Now, the bigger the car on an Alpine pass, the bigger the problems. You need something that's
breaking,
small,
that's
what's called, that you need something that's small that you can thread through, that you feel comfortable with the size with and so on. And I think the Cayman is probably a really good sweet spot. Now, I'm completely theorizing because I've never driven a Cayman.
Mate, have the keys.
Thank you.
Go for it.
I probably will take you up on that.
Yeah.
But But I'm theorizing here, but to me, just looking dimensionally at the size of the thing, I think that's probably where the sweet spot is.
Yeah.
I don't want something that's turbocharged in the Alps.
Right.
You don't want the lag. And if I want lag, I want proper lag.
Yeah, you want 80s. Nothing, massive amount.
Well, that's it. To me, that's the point of having a turbo. Yeah. Otherwise, you might as well go NA. If it's to, if it's for it to feel like it's not a turbo, then there's no point.
Yeah.
I mean, each to their own. But, you know, anyway, when you're in the mountains, you don't really want lag of any kind.
Yeah.
Really. Well, I don't anyway. And I think a Cayman with an NA engine and a manual gearbox up in the mountains would be lovely.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good one. But I think what turns me on really when it comes to cars isn't, like, for me, it's got to put a grin on my face.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to meeting other people and seeing other cars,
mm.
I don't really care what the car is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me whether it's a Citroen Saxo or a 959 or everything else in between.
Mm.
What interests me is kind of the stories behind the car and
yeah.
the people
yeah.
and the journeys they've been on. Like a box fresh car that's rolled off the showroom is boring. It's not of interest to me.
Yeah.
Whereas a car that someone's poured their heart and soul into, it's like when you pulled up with your car. That's really interesting to me.
Cool.
Because it's a car that you've made your own. You've done your modifications to. There are stories you can tell me. There are adventures you've been on, hopefully.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, what's it called? And that's a much more interesting proposition than a car that I can get the stats off the internet. Oh,
totally.
That car does 500 horsepower. I can read that off a brochure.
Yeah, yeah,
whereas
yeah.
I can't read about your car, you know, off a brochure. I'd need to meet you. I need to have a conversation with you. And I get a buzz out of feeding off of other people's enthusiasm for their cars and the adventures they've been on.
100%. And I mean, I think... Again, within, I think, 5 minutes of talking, we got onto this, and exactly the same. It is, apart from the engineering, the non-profit side of this, going out and meeting people and sharing those experiences and listening to their kind of history as to where they got to, because everybody's got something that drove them to where they are within this kind of arena, and especially turning it from, you know, something that's just being an enthusiast to being a job and, like, commercializing it in some way. That isn't by accident most of the time. There's somebody's made a life choice, especially in those early days where something is an idea. It hasn't. It's going to falter. It's going to do well. It's going to kind of judder its way along. And those people I find absolutely fascinating because you're living and breathing. You're not just kind of dipping your toe in, you know, an accountant on during the week, and then you'll jump in your kind of 140 grand GT3 and drive it to an event to show off and stand next to it for, and no disrespect to those guys that do that, that's just not someone I connect with. The stories I want to hear about are the people like yourself where you've gone like, no, I need to bury myself in this stuff up to the neck.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's about the people. Water cooled, air cooled, and everything else in between, I don't really care. What interests me is the person and that car. You know, what's been done to that car. Yeah, I like modifications. I think, you know, cars are mass produced for a mass market, which is fair enough. You know, they've got to appease shareholders and all the rest of it. Totally fine, I'm a capitalist. But the reality is that we're all individuals with individual requirements. And so a car that's mass produced isn't necessarily going to appeal to the individual, especially if you're an enthusiast.
Yeah.
So if you can make something your own, if you can take something and make it your own and make it the truest representation of what driving means to you, been awesome.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of cars that get under my skin.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky enough to have a few cars, and the low mileage rare stuff isn't the stuff I'll remember, you know, in years to come. My memories won't be of it gathering dust in the corner of a workshop. That's not really what interests me.
Yeah.
What interests me is the high mileage car that's not rare, but I've been able to pour my heart and soul into, really, really make it my own, make it something that best represents what driving means to me as an individual, not as a mass, not as a company selling as many cars as possible. And that I've made the most memories with, you know, that I've taken on an Alpine tour or this, that, the other. I look down there and I can see, I look at a car and I see, okay, that's me and Biscuit, my mini schnauzer, and full of luggage, and the air conditioning broke in Bologna in 45 degrees of heat with my wife swearing at me, and then us, you know, what's called having an argument about it, but then 10 minutes later laughing about how stupid the situation was.
Yeah.
And that was a memory, and that was a laugh, and that was great, and that's the type of stuff I take to the grave with me.
Yeah.
Not the memories of a car that's got no mileage and is sat in the corner of a workshop.
Yeah.
You know, so... So yeah, each to their own. I'm not here to judge. We all have to have an opinion, especially in this day and age on everything all the time. But sometimes I don't think we necessarily need to. And
I'm not here to judge anyone else.
You know, everybody uses cars in different ways. So yeah. I think that's fantastic. The world's big enough for everyone. But me personally, yeah, I just want to drive to the moon and back perpetually.
Why yeah. not? So again, trying to follow that thread through, right? So where did this? I mean, the detail. Like you're clearly heavily into design. Incredibly detail focused. I'm genuinely fascinated. How did this, what we're sitting in now, happen? How did that happen?
So in 2015, I sold my business. Yeah. It was a homeware electronics business. Nothing that I was really fascinated about. But I think that for me, the interest in that business was doing business as opposed to the subject matter.
Yeah.
Then I messed around for a couple of years trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. Had a couple of failures. A couple of non-starters, and then slowly, bit by bit, the idea for this started formulating. So I've been a Porsche enthusiast for a while now, and through my own cars, I met awesome industry professionals, whether it was modifications I was doing, this and the other, where I needed help on the cars, and also brilliant enthusiasts. You know what's called and just enjoyed that environment, and I wanted to create something. Little by little, the idea started formulating to create something where I could unite everyone in one place.
Yeah, yeah.
So this place is a glorified business park, effectively. Mm-hmm. Yes, the nuts and bolts of it is this 100-acre rural estate with lakes and woodland and all that stuff, and you know, some nice buildings on site. But essentially, that's all that we are. You know, we're a business park, and the idea is about bringing people together. So we're a house, and it's the people that make it home. So slowly, bit by bit, the idea of Boxing Gas started formulating, this idea of bringing people together. And so we had to look for a place that had the right amount of land, the right amount of buildings, and also be in the right location. And quite a few people told us that we were completely mad and we weren't going to find something that would fit all those criteria, because it is looking for a needle in a haystack in some regards.
Massively.
And actually, we were on this road trip in Italy with my wife, and we put an offer in on a place, subject to getting planning for it, up the road in Adbury. And it fell through. And I threw my toys out the pram. You know, we've been looking for quite a while at that point. And I just said to Emma, you know, everyone's right. We're never going to find something that's going to take years before we find something. And Emma's always the, I don't know, she's my compass, really. She keeps me on the straight and narrow. And she said, listen, let's just go back to the hotel room. Let's just start looking again. And I'm sure, you know, what's cool? Let's just finish our dinner and let's just go back and just start looking. I was like, okay, fine. You know, so she's there looking away, you know, online and everything, and I'm just sitting there, you know, feeling down at the dumps, feeling sorry for myself, like a right tool. And suddenly she says, I found something. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. She goes, yeah, fits all the criteria. I was like, yeah, go on, let's have a look. So I have a look on the laptop, and I'm like, Jesus, it's got everything that we need. It's got the right amount of land, it's got the right building, it's the right location. So we flew back the next day. We drove back the next day, sorry. And then we visited the place a couple of days later, and indeed it had all the right criteria for what we were trying to do. So we made an offer, subject to planning. The planning went through, and 6 years later, here we are sitting with you.
Wild. And the car. So the cars. Where I'm guessing you were. Did you have as many as you got now, or were you storing them all over the place?
And so there was a friend of mine who ran a seatbelt business, QuickFit.
I'm going to go and see them.
So they can do your car.
Yeah.
Great guy. I've known Stuart for years, and he's a very passionate guy. He's very talented at what he does. Mm. And anyway, he had in his workshop a bit of spare space. So I stored a few cars there. A few cars here. There. And I used to live in London, in central London. So. Mm. They were spread about all over the place. And also at the time I was running a business, you know, I was a middleman. In effect, that's kind of what I still am today.
Right.
You know, I was a middleman. So there was no reason for me to have any kind of presence or for the business to have any kind of presence.
Right.
Whereas when the idea for this started formulating, we needed to get it out there. We needed people to discover what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so it was a calculated way to make sure that we're on people's radar. I mean, to give you an idea, the marketing strategy was quite aggressive, actually. So I created a Facebook group for Porsche owners in the UK. and industry professionals. And the idea was to create the marketplace before you'd figure out exactly what the product was going to be, as opposed to doing it the other way around. So I added every single person that I knew within the Porsche circles, and then kept pushing people into that group, into that group, into that group, to the point it became to 20,000 members. Wow. And they're all highly, highly vetted. So we had to, there were a couple of friends who helped me out. I couldn't do it on my own. And we had to, you know, check that they were living in England, check that they were genuine Porsche owners and this and the other. And that way it was really a curated audience. And we knew that we had a really undiluted and pure database. Then by that point, the idea for this had already started formulating. And then the idea was, okay, right, so now I've got my marketplace to market to. I need to put in within this group every single owner of all the Porsche specialists around the country into one place. So that when I'm building this place, they're constantly getting updates on a regular basis without me having to knock on their door. So I'm not selling double glazing. So it's just an easier way to do it, you know. It's in their subconscious. It pops up in their newsfeed. It's constantly suffocating them with picture of this building, of this going up, without having to do a cold call.
Which is, again, that's crazy, because I mean, again, I'm trying to build something without. I'm not a marketeer. I'm not a business owner. I've never. I'm a bog standard employee of a company. So I'm low skilled, high enthusiasm, and it's interesting to hear your take on. That was is kind of the opposite. I almost feel like apologizing to everybody as I go. I'm like, I'm just learning here. And actually, your confidence levels going into that and kind of... And used the word aggressive, right? And I don't think you meant it in as a negative aggressive. It's like really push, like push, push, push.
No, I think I'm pretty relentless.
Yeah.
Once I get into an idea in my head, then it's just go, ravenous. Right. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't doubt myself. So when you say confidence, that's not the word for it. Relentless is one thing.
Right, okay.
But confidence is another, because I doubt myself, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
There are times when I had huge doubts, you know, and there are still times when I doubt myself massively with what's coming up as well. There's no guarantees in life.
No.
You know,
no.
You take risks, and either you succeed or you don't.
Yeah.
And you put yourself out there. But I think it doesn't matter whether you succeed or you don't. The fact of the matter is that you tried.
Yeah.
Fact of the matter is I can go to sleep at night saying I gave it my all.
Yeah.
And if I failed, it doesn't matter because it was all about the fact that I gave it a push.
Yeah.
Other people might not see it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what's called other people are taught about success. But actually, I don't think it's about that. I think it's about putting in the best that you possibly can. And then if it sticks, it sticks.
I think there's another element, though. And I think it coming back to design and kind of branding and stuff. It's part, I mean, there's lots of Porsche events out there. There's lots of people doing events. Some are great and they're really attractive and they're kind of like, oh, that is cool. Others are a bit more benign. And again, no disrespect to anyone because everyone's enthusiastic, but I think that's what set Oil Cool at the time. And now Megaphonics, like for me, it was the feel, the kind of aesthetic, the overall brand. It felt really... I don't know, like even having, it looks like it's polished concrete on the wall and things like that. The attention to detail, like I was saying before, I'm a detail guy. So for me, I was immediately attracted to all of this. It looked like nothing was an accident. And I don't think it is. There's like little discs on there's like a Rolling Stones book on the tape. Like it looks like you've gone around and gone, that book is 2 inches to the left.
Yeah, I drive my wife mad.
Is that a thing though? Is that pretty much accurate?
I think I am definitely obsessive.
Yeah.
But like all of us, you know, when we're enthusiastic and when you're passionate about something, you're going to be obsessive about things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what's called my wife, you know, like what's called, I'll go through tunnel vision into something and just kind of go down that rabbit hole. Like she says that I do that with music all the time.
Right. Okay.
Like at the end of the day, like I'm a blues guy, I'm a rock guy through and through.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I don't appreciate other things. So sometimes I'll go tunnel vision, I'll be into like Ibiza, you know, classic, experimental beach club style chill out music, you know,
yeah.
And I will dive into that to no end, you know, until the point where my wife goes, Jesus Christ,
can we just listen to something else
for a minute or two? I've got a bit of an obsessive personality trait, definitely, and I think that without wanting to sound grandiose, and this is probably going to sound awful, but I think all of us as individuals have been born with a certain set of tools, a certain capability. And it's up to us as individuals to kind of maximize what we've been given, I think. So I think that's kind of maybe
For you, is that a linear thing? Because for me, it's not. It's like, it's fully logarithmic. So I have stumbled my way through, and I feel like I'm now gaining confidence, self-confidence, to kind of put myself out there a little bit more, as I was talking before about, you know, filming myself and things like that. And it's growing, but it's now, it's kind of, it feels like it's lifting. Mm-hmm. Like, even sitting down and having this conversation with you, 3 or 4 years ago, A, I'd have struggled with that. It's somebody new, I would probably get a bit of social anxiety. And then, but yeah, this feels like we've been doing this for decades. For me, anyway, totally. It feels like we've been doing it for a long time. So
no, I totally agree with you. I mean, like, what's called, I remember doing an interview however many years ago it was, and I remember just being so anxious and so worried about this and the other. Like I said, like my previous business, the whole thing is I was a submarine, you know, nobody would see me coming. I'd be, you know, nice and underneath. I wouldn't be dealing with the end user. Mm. You know, what's called, I was literally putting together manufacturers and retailers together. So I never had to put my head up against the precipice. You couldn't find me.
Yeah.
Whereas with this business, you know, what's called, by nature of trying to attract an audience and trying to attract clients, I've had to put my head above the precipice a lot. And it was suddenly something I wasn't very comfortable with, and I felt very awkward and strange. Mm. Whereas now I'm starting to feel a bit more relaxed about it. And funnily enough, the more you relax and the more you're yourself, the easier it becomes.
Agree more.
And it's so stupid, but it's so obvious, but it's so true. I mean, like, I don't know, it's taken me a little while, but I, like you, I think like anyone, you know, what's called, it takes time for us to feel comfortable sometimes in our own skin.
And even to the extent, because I think the internet and social media can be so judgmental, me coming into this and loving Porsche but not being an encyclopedia, really worried about, you know, me saying something and someone will go, well, that's wrong. And it's funny that what I've done is I've lent into it and be like, openly say, I am like right at the beginning of my journey of properly learning, not just kind of going, oh, well, that's a, even just identifying what a 928 looks like or what a 914 looks like. I kind of do that, but everything else, be like knowing that, I don't know what you said, whether it's an 89 or a 90, is a C4 only, it doesn't come in a 2. These are the things that, they just, that stuff, you kind of build that knowledge out.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But just lean into it. You know, I'm not going to, whereas, and before, I think I would have tried to, I have to be a certain way because that's what public would expect from somebody that's going to talk about Porsche. Whereas now I'm like,
anybody that's going to criticize someone for not having the knowledge on a specific subject, it's not worth the time. We don't have time for that. I mean, like, no. With Megaphonic specifically, like, I like to think of it as like, as very inclusive. For me, fundamentally, Porsche is an inclusive brand.
Yeah.
Like, you can get everything from a 3 grand Boxster, which is a phenomenal car.
Amazing, yeah.
You know, and like huge amounts of car for the money, all the way up to a multi-million pound collector Porsche. But the fact of, and that's awesome, because you get people from all different walks of life. With all different, it's such a broad church. So, whereas like Ferraris, Lamborghinis, something like that, you know, they're 5 figures minimum to get into them. Yeah. So there's a certain demographic there. And so because Porsche is available to everyone, relatively speaking, from 3 grand all the way up to a multi-million pound collector car, it's not an exclusive brand, it's an inclusive brand. And I think that's what I kind of wanted Megaphonics to be about. Yes, okay, it's an air-cooled event, in inverted commas, but fundamentally, I don't think we're snobby in any way, shape, or form
at all. I didn't find that.
You know, like, there's room for everyone, and what's interesting to me is the enthusiasm more than there is everything else. And later down the line, when I have more time and when we finish the buildings, and that also gives us the infrastructure to be able to do more. We'll do lots more events, not just about the air-cooled stuff. We'll do water-cooled stuff, transaxle stuff. I mean, there's so much awesome stuff in the Porsche, in the Porsche world. And then we'll go further than that. Because I think, yes, we're all Porsche guys, but we're all car guys. We're all mechanical guys. We're all into design. We're all into clothes, all these different things. And you look at Megaphonics, and yes, it's a Porsche event, but fundamentally we get jewelry guys. You know, where there's jewelry brands there. There's Reino, who's also a Porsche guy. You get Deus, who was sponsoring a couple of years ago. And Carby is a Porsche guy. You know, what's called, we all have different interests, but funnily enough, those interests tend to be relatively similar. So what I'm trying to say is that with Megaphonics, we harbor more than just the Porsche interest in our demographic, whether it's glasses, fashion, jewelry, whatever it may well be, cafe racer motorcycles and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I think that Boxing Gas as a brand has got to recognize that.
Yeah.
And I think that Porsche needs to empower us. It doesn't need to restrict us.
Yeah.
And it will always be our core and in our DNA. But fundamentally, we're more than just Porsche as enthusiasts. Mm. And I think it's important that our brand represents that. Now, it'll always be very highly curated. Mm. We'll always highly curate the things that really get under our skin and that our demographic are into. Mm. But we certainly won't let Porsche restrict us. We'll make that empower us, and we'll do things which are non-Porsche as well.
Talking about we, how much of it is your vision and how much of it is shared with Autofarm and your partner and your friends and other people that you know that you're sort of networking is? It feels like it that you, in the same way you're talking about my Cayman and like, oh man, you've already got like you can see what the end looks like. Mm. Is that the same for you with this whole kind of situation?
Yeah,
you can visualize what the future looks like.
And yeah, definitely 100%. Yeah. So in my previous business, I was my business partner was my cousin. Right. And we were together always, and we'd have great days, we'd have bad days. Some days I'd hate him, other days I'd love him. Mm. But either way, we were together, you know, and that was awesome. We'd always play ping pong, in inverted commas, as a way to ping pong. I'm using that as a metaphor for bouncing ideas back and forth, having someone to an echo chamber, or also, not an echo chamber, but having someone to share ideas with, to brainstorm with. And in some ways, that's awesome. In some ways, that's restrictive, especially when you start having investors and you know board meetings and all sorts of boring stuff. That can crush your creativity.
Yeah.
Whereas with this business, I'm doing it fully on my own. You know, right, I don't have investors. Right. I don't have a business partner. It is purely my vision.
Yeah.
So it means that it's awesome because I'm free to do exactly what I want and make it absolutely authentic to what I believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
But it also means that it's absolutely fucking terrifying. Because if I fail, I fail, you know, massively. And the responsibilities are purely on my shoulders.
Yeah. So there's something you said a minute ago that, because re-engineering is a similar situation, right? So it's my baby. I've now slowly but created in my head what I think it would look like at the end. And I'm very slowly trying to chase it because it's not my day job. And I'm conscious. So I podcast every week, right? And then last week we lost one of our dogs. We had three dogs and
I'm sorry to hear that. That's awful.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, it's tough.
And I didn't put anything out. And so my social media efforts kind of dipped a little bit. And I went and I recorded one that was like an apology almost, like, for sorry, I didn't put anything out. And then I re-recorded one as like, the opposite, I'm making no apologies, absolutely none whatsoever. Everybody, really, I'd love to see this as people move away from that kind of feeling of having to commit to this stuff, right? Mm. But I think my point was is that you were talking about this being on your shoulders and it just being you and what happens if it fails. But then earlier on, we were talking about like failure is a part of this journey and, you know, and I guess the bit that, because I was thinking about, well, what if engineering fails? It's going to feel pretty rough, right? Because I've got this vision, I want to achieve it. But also I'm trying to live in that space of, I don't want to focus on the success or failure of something. I just want to be more present.
I think it's a universal problem nowadays, especially in the Western world, where we're definitely not present enough, for sure. Definitely. I think, you know, we could all do with taking a step back and actually looking at how far we've all come as individuals.
Mm.
You know, what's good if I told you where, if I told you 10 years ago where you'd be today, I'm sure you'd be pretty happy with yourself.
If you told me, I think probably 5 years ago. So what was I doing 5 years ago? I was working, had a pretty nasty health issue. I was in a job that was hard, but it was growth for me. I'd just left the military. I didn't have a Porsche. I had a half-built Lotus Elise that was still in bits that I felt pretty down about because I'd not really completed it. And I had this date, an arbitrary date. We always do that. Well, I've done that. Give myself a date where something should be done by. So all of it felt a bit like all over the place. So yeah, no question, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, definitely this would have seemed like a pipe dream. Five years ago, this would have seemed like, wouldn't that be lovely? But I don't know, we'll wait and see. And then here I am sat with you. Which makes me think again, like, success or failure, irrelevant. I don't know what's going to happen in five more years,
right?
It's
the effort that you put in. It doesn't matter whether you succeed or whether you fail. The fact of the matter is you gave it your all.
100%.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
You know, what's it called? I think it's too easy to sit on the sidelines watching, you know, what's called in criticizing. And actually, it doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is you put in the effort. And that's what keeps me going. You know, like what's called, I've had moments when I've had serious doubts.
Yeah.
Serious doubts about this and the other. But for some reason, my wife has always had this relentless belief in me. And that's what's empowered me to keep going.
That's what's empowered me to
just really just be relentless about it.
Yeah.
But she's been absolutely amazing. I fundamentally couldn't do it without her. 100%. You know, and she's been through it, because the thing is like, you know, when you're in a relationship, as anybody who's in a relationship will tell you, when one of you goes through something, the other one goes through it as well.
Absolutely.
You know, and this project had a huge amounts of challenges and huge amounts of problems to overcome. That I really won't bore you with. So Emma went through it as well.
Yeah.
100%. She went through it as well. So it was tough on her as well. But
drawing it all the way back to something we both said, it's probably a nice finish actually before we do a little bit of a quick tour around. But again, off camera, within a few minutes of meeting, we both sort of said, you know, you really got to take a bit of perspective on where you are and how fortunate you are. And I mean you as in the royal you, and it's true, right? It's like those. It sounds like such a cliche, all that hard stuff kind of...
It is a cliche, but it's
But it's a true cliche, isn't it? Like that you... Yeah. Those things that you go through them and they're difficult and they're... At the time, they feel like the end of the world and then you kind of move past it.
At the end of the day, you know, what's called, we've all got to get perspective. And like the reality is that everything is bullshit apart from the fact that you need a roof over your head and food on your plate.
Yeah.
You have those. That's the fundamentals. Yeah. Everything else afterwards is just surplus. You know, what's called, and Emma reminds me of that. She goes, like, if it all fails and it all cocks up and it all goes to shit, it doesn't fucking matter. We have each other.
Yeah.
We'll have a roof over our heads and we'll have food on the table. And it, you know, that's all that matters. That's all that matters.
That is all that matters, guys. You know, like, it sounds like a bit of a Disney ending, really, but it does, but let's face it, these things are the truth, aren't they?
It is the truth.
Everything else is the sort of tinsel on the tree, but... Yeah. Frank, thank you so much. This genuinely could have been, you know, a mate down a pub, sat there chewing the fat for an hour, and I've loved every minute of it.
Good. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to meet another enthusiast. You know? And as soon as you pulled up in your car, I was like, I think I'm going to get along fine with this person. We started talking about it. There was connection there. And it's funny that, isn't it? How you can bond with someone that you've never met before if you guys have an interest in common.
Yeah.
Your car represents you and speaks volumes. So it almost was obvious that actually it was going to be a good chat, I think.
Cool. Well, thanks so much. If it's all right, we'll do a quick wander around and you can point out your favourites and I'll get some panning shots of that kind of the green car with road rash all over it if it's here.
Sure.
Yeah, a few bits and pieces of that.
Sounds good.
So, walk me through, is everything in here yours, or is it?
Guilty. So this is what, I don't know, I'm going to say 15 years of buying, selling, as I go, as an enthusiast. So there's, you have to remember that all those years ago, these cars were certainly not as desirable as
they were. No. Magnus Walker said the same thing, if he's had to start getting that, he couldn't.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so it's been a little while.
So this is in the works, or
yeah. So this is the
Oliver. Oh, is this the one you're on about?
Yeah, this is the Oliver XT. We were staying down at Folkestone the night before.
Yeah.
And then the next day we were getting up early to get on the train to get going. And this car has a starting procedure that is quite peculiar, like a lot of these cars.
Idiosyncrasy,
is the right word. And And because the other cars had started before mine, I couldn't really hear it, so I wasn't really quite listening and quite catching it quite right. Anyway, I ended up flooding the fucking engine.
Okay.
And I couldn't get it going, Eventually I said, listen guys, you got everything on the sat navs, just go ahead, yeah. I'll catch up with you.
Yeah.
What's called, I'll call it the RAC guy. So, and one of the guys left me a jump start pack, so I start trying to jump start the car. And the car just won't go. And eventually, call the RAC guy, and the RAC guy's on the way. So, in the meantime, my infinite wisdom, I go to wind down the passenger window, and the glass falls straight into the door. Oh, lucky it didn't smash, but it falls straight into the door. So I get the spanners out, and I start taking the whole thing apart, and I've got grease in my hair, and like my beard, and my face, and everything's all over the place. And this is in the car park of the hotel, and. Eventually, I managed to wind it all the way up, but then I need something to hold it up, like a piece of wood or something.
Yeah.
And I spot in the corner of my skip, so I jump into the skip, and I'm jumping up and down on this pallet that I found to snap off a piece of wood.
Right.
All the hotel guests are waking up, and I look like a mad homeless person.
Yeah, yeah.
And just as I'm getting out of the skip, the RAC man arrives, so he's thinking, what the fuck's going on as well. And then I fix the window, duct tape it, you know, the best I can, and lodge the piece of wood. And then the RAC guy starts trying to start the car as well with his jumper pack. We're using carb cleaner and it's almost going, it's just not having it.
Right.
And eventually his jump pack completely dies. So he says, okay, well, we're going to have to tow it back. I'm like, fuck, okay, well, let's just try one more time with my friend's small jump pack.
Yeah.
We'll try one more time, the car started. And then I did the journey.
Because I had a similar situation, I had a core pack die on the ring, coming back down the straight as if I was going to head to the car park. And it was a K-Series at the time, trying to get in a K-Series coil pack in Germany. Nope. And everyone else was like, guys, we've got to go. We can't hang around for you. And I dealt with it really badly. I was a miserable, angry, small person at that point.
This is the thing, like, what's it called? You know, I love old cars, but at the same time, sometimes, like, when all this shit kicks off, and I can't remember what it was, one car caught fire, the other car, like the
really?
Gearbox blew up, something else happened to another car in the space of like a month. And at that point, I was just like, you know what, I just want to sell everything, or set everything on fire.
Right.
And just what's called, and then just go and buy myself a brand new 911 with a fucking warranty that lasts 3 years. You know, just stop this shit.
So I am glad.
Keeping old cars on the road is a fucking challenge.
Yeah,
it's difficult.
Is.
And it's really rewarding when it all works, but when it doesn't work, it is really frustrating.
Yeah.
But it's part of the journey, and it makes it worthwhile when everything does come together.
For sure.
When all the ingredients are just right, you know, the road is dry, the sun is out, it's clear, there's no one around.
The
oil's just at the right temperature.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's glorious. But the rest of the time, it can be very frustrating.
So what is the spec of this car then?
So this car started off life as a 69 long wheelbase, and then it was built to ST specifications, so it's got ST steel arches, and then it's running a 3-litre MFI, basically RSR engine, that we've dropped out. There's a known fault on the engine cases of these, where there's like what looks like a hole but isn't a hole, and the way to do it properly is to weld it up with a chemical weld. And the person, at some point or another, someone's done it with a piece of silicone. So it's not really the proper way. So we dropped the engine to be able to do that and to give the engine a proper, really good service.
Yeah.
The calipers need rebuilding as well. And
so the calipers, what are the calipers from? They're not
the front caliper. So the fronts are turbo items, and I think the rear ones are from a Boxster, actually.
Okay.
Memory.
I can't
remember. It's terrible, but yeah. So there's a real mismatch of things on the spot. But the point is that it got me back, but it was hanging on for dear life. Because, I mean, even the front right caliper was just, the pistons were just starting to stick.
Right, okay.
And, you know, when you're bounding into a fucking hairpin at a very reasonable speed, you know, the last thing you want when you've got a cliff edge is for something to bind up properly. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking, yeah.
And this is is this a favourite, or is it a stretch to say you have a favourite?
The favourite is a car that is actually called Black Betty that's been off the road for 7 years now, so you wouldn't know it.
Right.
Because the theory is it's Black Betty and company, so and company is the other cars and Black Betty is
Okay, that makes sense.
But that car's been off the road for 7 years, and it was just the name of that car in a forum handle name before social media kicked off. And that car's my favourite because because it's the one I've driven the most and the one I've modified the most.
Right.
And it's nothing rare or low mileage. If anything, it's the opposite.
Really?
Yeah.
And so where, out of interest then, if that's the favourite, how come it's not in here being worked on?
Because it is being worked on. The engine's over here.
Okay.
Your light is for the engine, so and I'm rebuilding it again.
Right,
so for the third time, the third iteration. And then the bodywork, the metalwork's all being done and completed. So this is a 3.8 litre engine, hotel cased, forged rods, 3.8 litre Marlow barrels and pistons, titanium springs and retainers, high lift cams, bored and polished heads, and then a slightly lower compression to 10.1.
Okay.
These intake panels we made ourselves for this, so they're made of pieces of solid billet.
Okay.
Same with the bracketry here. And then this is not an air conditioning unit. This is actually a centrifugal supercharger.
Okay. It is a centrifugal supercharger.
Yeah, and then the intercooler goes over the top. And so it goes back to what I was...
When you said it was slightly low compression, I was like, there's forced induction coming.
Yeah. So this is the conversation we were having earlier. So like a lot of times with Porsches, or a lot of times with cars, when people start modifying cars, they don't have a clear path of what exactly they're trying to achieve, or exactly how they're going to use the car.
Yeah.
And the car ends up being compromised in one shape or form.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When it came to Black Betty, when it came to that car, you know, my favourite car, I wanted to have a very clear idea of what is the car going to do, and then I can formulate exactly how I'm going to modify it. So, as we were saying earlier, my favourite thing to do is alpine passes. So the car, every little aspect of the car, down to, from the wheels, all the way up to the roof, and everything else in between, is fully designed to be good at alpine passes.
So
the ratios in the gearbox, you know, the fact that the wheels, there are, it's my own design, and they have stainless dishes, which are much, much stronger than the aluminium ones. You know, just all sorts of little details and think bits and pieces to make it.
Exactly what you want. And funnily enough, mate, the tagline for engineering is design for purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Same principle, right? Mm-hmm. Pick something that is going to do, and then design everything around it. Don't kind of make it
master of none.
Yeah, master of none. That bothers me. And again, that's partly why you get new cars are fine, but they're designed to be a master of none. They're designed to just do a broad spread of everything, and that's just not what I'm about. I would rather pick alpine passes and kind of go, right, that's, you know.
In the engineering sense. It affects everything. It's like, for example, if you're going to build a track car, you're going to use maybe cup twos, you know, tyres.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're going to do alpine passes, a Michelin Pilot Sport Contact 5 or whatever it is, Pilot Sport 5 is probably the one that you want.
Yeah.
So the purpose is so important. The settings on suspension, the brakes, the weight of the car, the interior trim, all those bits and pieces can be affected by when you use a car.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed that episode. I definitely did. I enjoy it. I say to him in the actual episode that I think it's one of my favourites. And for sure, you know, I've shot loads of these already. And the order's coming out a bit higgledy-piggledy because it's not in order of how they were shot. But it really felt like Frank and I were just good old mates and we just sat down having a chat. So I hope that came across. And I hope you enjoyed the episode. As I say, I'll be back. I'll be back next week. And then I'll disappear for 3 weeks. I should, there's no reason why I can't be back next week. I'm going to record the intro and as much as I can from the Cars and Coffee, the Reengineering Cars and Coffee, supported by Legends Drivers Club as well. And so next week's episode you should get pretty quickly actually after that happens, and then the first episode about the kind of the sort of history of my Cayman and I've got to where I am now modifying it. That'll drop pretty shortly after as well. Anyway, I hope you have a lovely week, and I shall see you again soon. Take care for now. Bye bye.